Chapter 14. From the crow's nest, and so after strange delays, and through an avenue of doubt and battle, this man from the 19th century came at last to his position at the head of that complex world. At first, when he rose from the long deep sleep that followed his rescue, and the surrender of the council, he did not recognize his surroundings. By an effort he gained a clue in his mind, and all that had happened came back to him, at first with a quality of insincerity like a story heard, like something read out of a book. And even before his memories were clear, the exultation of his escape, the wonder of his prominence, were back in his mind. He was owner of half the world, master of the earth. This new great age was in the completest sense his. He no longer hoped to discover his experiences a dream. He became anxious now to convince himself that they were real. An obsequious valet assisted him to dress under the direction of a dignified chief attendant, a little man whose face proclaimed him Japanese, albeit he spoke English like an Englishman. From the latter he learned something of the state of affairs. Already the revolution was an accepted fact. Already business was being resumed throughout the city. Abroad the downfall of the council had been received for the most part with delight. Nowhere was the council popular, and the thousand cities of Western America, after 200 years still jealous of New York, London, and the East, had risen almost unanimously 2 days before at the news of Graham's imprisonment. Paris was fighting within itself. The rest of the world hung in suspense. While he was breaking his fast, the sound of a telephone bell jetted from a corner, and his chief attendant called his attention to the voice of Ostrog making polite inquiries. Graham interrupted his refreshment to reply. Very shortly Lincoln arrived, and Graham at once expressed a strong desire to talk to people, and to be shown more of the new life that was opening before him. Lincoln informed him that in 3 hours' time a representative gathering of officials and their wives would be held in the state apartments of the Wind Vane chief. Graham's desire to traverse the ways of the city was, however, at present impossible, because of the enormous excitement of the people. It was, however, quite possible for him to take a bird's eye view of the city from the crow's nest of the Wind Vane keeper. To this accordingly Graham was conducted by his attendant. Lincoln, with a graceful compliment to the attendant, apologized for not accompanying them, on account of the present pressure of administrative work. Higher even than the most gigantic wind wheels hung this crow's nest, a clear 1,000 feet above the roofs, a little disc-shaped speck on a spear of metallic filigree, cable-stayed. To its summit Graham was drawn in a little wire-hung cradle. Halfway down the frail-seeming stem was a light gallery about which hung a cluster of tubes minute they looked from above rotating slowly on the ring of its outer rail. These were the specula, en rapport with the Wind Vane keeper's mirrors, in one of which Ostrog had shown him the coming of his rule. His Japanese attendant ascended before him, and they spent nearly an hour asking and answering questions. It was a day full of the promise and quality of spring. The touch of the wind warmed. The sky was an intense blue, and the vast expanse of London shone dazzling under the morning sun. The air was clear of smoke and haze, sweet as the air of a mountain glen. Save for the irregular oval of ruins about the House of the Council, and the black flag of the surrender that fluttered there, the mighty city seen from above showed few signs of the swift revolution that had, to his imagination, in one night and one day, changed the destinies of the world. A multitude of people still swarmed over these ruins, and the huge open-work stagings in the distance from which started in times of peace the service of aeroplanes to the various great cities of Europe and America, were also black with the victors. Across a narrow way of planking raised on trestles that crossed the ruins a crowd of workmen were busy restoring the connection between the cables and wires of the council house and the rest of the city, preparatory to the transfer thither of Ostrog's headquarters from the Wind Vane buildings. For the rest the luminous expanse was undisturbed. So vast was its serenity in comparison with the areas of disturbance, that presently Graham, looking beyond them, could almost forget the thousands of men lying out of sight in the artificial glare within the quasi-subterranean labyrinth, dead or dying of the overnight wounds, forget the improvised wards with the hosts of surgeons, nurses, and bearers feverishly busy, forget, indeed, apostrophe all the wonder, consternation and novelty under the electric lights. Down there in the hidden ways of the anthill he knew that the revolution triumphed, that black everywhere carried the day, black favors, black banners, black festoons across the streets. And out here, under the fresh sunlight, beyond the crater of the fight, as if nothing had happened to the earth, the forest of wind vanes, that had grown from one or two, while the council had ruled, roared peacefully upon their incessant duty. Far away, spiked, jagged and indented by the wind vanes, the Surrey hills rose blue and faint. To the north and nearer, the sharp contours of Highgate and Muswell Hill were similarly jagged. And all over the countryside, he knew, on every crest and hill, where once the hedges had interlaced, and cottages, churches, inns, and farmhouses had nestled among their trees, wind wheels similar to those he saw, and bearing like vast advertisements, gaunt and distinctive symbols of the new age, cast their whirling shadows and stored incessantly the energy that flowed away incessantly through all the arteries of the city. And underneath these wandered the countless flocks and herds of the British Food Trust with their lonely guards and keepers. Not a familiar outline anywhere broke the cluster of gigantic shapes below. St. Paul's he knew survived, and many of the old buildings in Westminster, embedded out of sight, arched over and covered in among the giant growths of this great age. The Thames, too, made no fall and gleam of silver to break the wilderness of the city. The thirsty water mains drank up every drop of its waters before they reached the walls. Its bed and estuary scoured and sunken was now a canal of sea water, and a race of grimy bargemen brought the heavy materials of trade from the pool thereby beneath the very feet of the workers. Faint and dim in the eastward between earth and sky hung the clustering masts of the colossal shipping in the pool. For all the heavy traffic, for which there was no need of haste, came in gigantic sailing ships from the ends of the earth, and the heavy goods for which there was urgency in mechanical ships of a smaller, swifter sort. And to the south over the hills, came vast aqueducts with sea water for the sowers, and in three separate directions, ran pallid lines the roads, stippled with moving gray specks. On the first occasion that offered, he was determined to go out and see these roads. That would come after the flying ship he was presently to try. His attendant officer described them as a pair of gently curving surfaces 100 yards wide, each one for the traffic going in one direction, and made of a substance called eatamite, an artificial substance, so far as he could gather, resembling toughened glass. Along this shot a strange traffic of narrow rubber-shod vehicles, great single wheels, two- and four-wheeled vehicles, sweeping along at velocities of from 1 to 6 miles a minute. Railroads had vanished. A few embankments remained as rust-crowned trenches here and there. Some few formed the cores of Eatamite ways. Among the first things to strike his attention had been the great fleets of advertisement balloons and kites that receded in irregular vistas northward and southward along the lines of the aeroplane journeys. No aeroplanes were to be seen. Their passages had ceased, and only one little seeming aeropile circled high in the blue distance above the Surrey hills, an unimpressive soaring speck. A thing Graham had already learned, and which he found very hard to imagine, was that nearly all the towns in the country, and almost all the villages, had disappeared. Here and there only, he understood, some gigantic hotel-like edifice stood amid square miles of some single cultivation, and preserved the name of a town as Bournemouth, Wareham, or Swanage. Yet the officer had speedily convinced him how inevitable such a change had been. The old order had dotted the country with farmhouses, and every 2 or 3 miles was the ruling landlord's estate, and the place of the inn and cobbler, the grocer's shop and church, the village. Every 8 miles or so was the country town, where lawyer, corn merchant, wool stapler, saddler, veterinary surgeon, doctor, draper, milliner and so forth lived. Every 8 miles simply because that 8 mile marketing journey, for there and back, was as much as was comfortable for the farmer. But directly the railways came into play, and after them the light railways, and all the swift new motor cars, that had replaced wagons and horses, and so soon as the high roads began to be made of wood, and rubber, and eatamite, and all sorts of elastic durable substances, the necessity of having such frequent market towns disappeared. And the big towns grew. They drew the worker with the gravitational force of seemingly endless work, the employer with their suggestions of an infinite ocean of labor. And as the standard of comfort rose, as the complexity of the mechanism of living increased, life in the country had become more and more costly, or narrow and impossible. The disappearance of vicar and squire, the extinction of the general practitioner by the city specialist, had robbed the village of its last touch of culture. After telephone, kinematograph, and phonograph had replaced newspaper, book, schoolmaster, and letter, to live outside the range of the electric cables was to live an isolated savage. In the country, were neither means of being clothed, nor fed according to the refined conceptions of the time, no efficient doctors for an emergency, no company and no pursuits. Moreover, mechanical appliances in agriculture made one engineer the equivalent of 30 laborers. So, inverting the condition of the city clerk in the days when London was scarce inhabitable, because of the coaly foulness of its air, the laborers now came hurrying by road or air to the city, and its life and delights at night, to leave it again in the morning. The city had swallowed up humanity. Man had entered upon a new stage in his development. First had come the nomad, the hunter, then had followed the agriculturist of the agricultural state, whose towns and cities and ports were but the headquarters and markets of the countryside. And now, logical consequence of an epoch of invention, was this huge new aggregation of men. Save London, there were only four other cities in Britain: Edinburgh, Portsmouth, Manchester, and Shrewsbury. Such things as these, simple statements of fact, though they were to contemporary men, strained Graham's imagination to picture. And when he glanced far beyond there at the strange things that existed on the continent, it failed him altogether. He had a vision of city beyond city, cities on great plains, cities beside great rivers, vast cities along the sea margin, cities girdled by snowy mountains. Over a great part of the earth the English tongue was spoken, taken together with its Spanish American, and Hindu and Negro and Indian dialects. It was the everyday language of two-thirds of the people of the earth. On the continent, save as remote and curious survivals, three other languages alone held sway: German, which reached to Antioch and Genoa, and jostled Spanish English at Gdiz, a Gallicized Russian which met the Indian English in Persia and Kurdistan, and the Indian English in Pekin, and French still clear and brilliant, the language of lucidity, which shared the Mediterranean with the Indian English, and German and reached through a Negro dialect to the Congo. And everywhere now, through the city set earth, save in the administered lac belt territories of the tropics, the same cosmopolitan social organization prevailed, and everywhere from pole to equator his property and his responsibilities extended. The whole world was civilized. The whole world dwelt in cities. The whole world was property. Over the British Empire, and throughout America, his ownership was scarcely disguised. Congress and Parliament were usually regarded as antique, curious gatherings. And even in the two empires of Russia and Germany, the influence of his wealth was conceivably of enormous weight. There, of course, came problems, possibilities, but, uplifted as he was, even Russia and Germany seemed sufficiently remote. And of the quality of the Black Belt administration, and of what that might mean for him, he thought, after the fashion of his former days, not at all. that it should hang like a thread over the spacious vision before him could not enter his 19th century mind. But his mind turned at once from the scenery to the thought of a vanished dread. What of the yellow peril? He asked, and Asano made him explain. The Chinese specter had vanished. Chinaman and European were at peace. The 20th century had discovered with reluctant certainty that the average Chinaman was as civilized, more moral, and far more intelligent than the average European serf, and had repeated on a gigantic scale the fraternization of Scot and Englishmen that happened in the 17th century. As Asano put it, they thought it over. They found we were white men after all. Graham turned again to the view, and his thoughts took a new direction. Out of the dim southwest, glittering and strange, voluptuous, and in some way terrible, shone those pleasure cities, of which the kinematograph, phonograph, and the old man in the street had spoken. Strange places reminiscent of the legendary Cyprus, cities of art and beauty, mercenary art and mercenary beauty, sterile wonderful cities of motion and music, whither repaired all who profited by the fierce, inglorious, economic struggle that went on in the glaring labyrinth below. Fierce he knew it was. How fierce he could judge from the fact that these latter-day people referred back to the England of the 19th century as the figure of an idyllic easy-going life. He turned his eyes to the scene immediately before him again, trying to conceive the big factories of that intricate maze. Northward he knew were the potters, makers not only of earthenware and china, but of the kindred pastes and compounds a subtler mineralogical chemistry had devised. There were the makers of statuettes and wall ornaments and much intricate furniture. There too were the factories, where feverishly competitive authors devised their phonograph discourses and advertisements, and arranged the groupings and developments for their perpetually startling and novel kinematographic dramatic works. Thence too, flashed the worldwide messages, the worldwide falsehoods of the news tellers, the chargers of the telephonic machines that had replaced the newspapers of the past. To the westward beyond the smashed council house were the voluminous offices of municipal control and government, and to the eastward, towards the port, the trading quarters, the huge public markets, the theaters, houses of resort, betting palaces, miles of billiard saloons, baseball and football circuses, wild beast rings and the innumerable temples of the Christian and quasi-Christian sects, the Mohammedans, Buddhists, Gnostics, spook worshippers, the incubus worshippers, the furniture worshippers, and so forth. And to the south again a vast manufacture of textiles, pickles, wines and condiments. And from point to point, tore the countless multitudes along the roaring mechanical ways. A gigantic hive, of which the winds were tireless servants, and the ceaseless wind vanes an appropriate crown and symbol. He thought of the unprecedented population that had been sucked up by this sponge of halls and galleries, the 33 million lives that were playing out each its own brief ineffectual drama below him, and the complacency that the brightness of the day and the space and splendor of the view, and above all the sense of his own importance, had begotten, dwindled, and perished. Looking down from this height over the city, it became at last possible to conceive this overwhelming multitude of 33 millions, the reality of the responsibility he would take upon himself, the vastness of the human maelstrom over which his slender kingship hung. He tried to figure the individual life. It astonished him to realize how little the common man had changed in spite of the visible change in his conditions. Life and property, indeed, were secure from violence almost all over the world. Zoonotic diseases, bacterial diseases of all sorts had practically vanished. Everyone had a sufficiency of food and clothing, was warmed in the city ways and sheltered from the weather, so much the almost mechanical progress of science and the physical organization of society had accomplished. But the crowd, he was already beginning to discover, was a crowd still, helpless in the hands of demagogue and organizer, individually cowardly, individually swayed by appetite, collectively incalculable. The memory of countless figures in pale blue canvas came before his mind. Millions of such men and women below him, he knew, had never been out of the city, had never seen beyond the little round of unintelligent, grudging participation in the world's business, and unintelligent, dissatisfied sharing in its tawdrier pleasures. He thought of the hopes of his vanished contemporaries, and for a moment the dream of London and Morris's quaint old news from nowhere, and the perfect land of Hudson's beautiful crystal age appeared before him in an atmosphere of infinite loss. He thought of his own hopes. For in the latter days of that passionate life, that lay now so far behind him, the conception of a free and equal manhood had become a very real thing to him. He had hoped, as indeed his age had hoped, rashly taking it for granted, that the sacrifice of the many to the few would someday cease, that a day was near when every child born of woman should have a fair and assured chance of happiness. And here, after 200 years, the same hope, still unfulfilled, cried passionately through the city. After 200 years, he knew, greater than ever, grown with the city to gigantic proportions, were poverty and helpless labor and all the sorrows of his time. Already he knew something of the history of the intervening years. He had heard now of the moral decay that had followed the collapse of supernatural religion in the minds of ignoble man, the decline of public honor, the ascendancy of wealth. For men who had lost their belief in God had still kept their faith in property, and wealth ruled a venial world. His Japanese attendant, Asano, in expounding the political history of the intervening 2 centuries, drew an apt image from a seed eaten by insect parasites. First there is the original seed, ripening vigorously enough. And then comes some insect, and lays an egg under the skin, and behold, in a little while the seed is a hollow shape with an active grub inside that has eaten out its substance. And then comes some secondary parasite, some ichneumon fly, and lays an egg within this grub, and behold, that too, is a hollow shape, and the new living thing is inside its predecessor's skin which itself is snug within the seed coat. And the seed coat still keeps its shape. Most people think it a seed still, and for all one knows it may still think itself a seed, vigorous and alive. Why, your Victorian kingdom, said Asano, was like that kingship with the heart eaten out. The landowners, the barons and gentry began ages ago with King John. There were lapses, but they beheaded King Charles, and ended practically with King George, mere husk of a king. The real power in the hands of their parliament. But the parliament, the organ of the landholding tenant ruling gentry, did not keep its power long. The change had already come in the 19th century. The franchises had been broadened until it included masses of ignorant men, urban myriads, who went in their featureless thousands to vote together. And the natural consequence of a swarming constituency is the rule of the party organization. Power was passing even in the Victorian time to the party machinery, secret, complex, and corrupt. Very speedily power was in the hands of great men of business who financed the machines. A time came when the real power and interest of the empire rested visibly between the 2 party councils, ruling by newspapers and electoral organizations 2 small groups of rich and able men, working at first in opposition, then presently together. There was a reaction of a genteel ineffectual sort. There were numberless books in existence, Asano said, to prove that the publication of some of them was as early as Graham's Sleep, a whole literature of reaction in fact. The party of the reaction seems to have locked itself into its study and rebelled with unflinching determination on paper. The urgent necessity of either capturing or depriving the party councils of power is a common suggestion underlying all the thoughtful work of the early 20th century, both in America and England. In most of these things America was a little earlier than England, though both countries drove the same way. That counter-revolution never came. It could never organize and keep pure. There was not enough of the old sentimentality, the old faith in righteousness, left among men. Any organization that became big enough to influence the Poles became complex enough to be undermined, broken up, or bought outright by capable rich men. Socialistic and popular, reactionary, and purity parties were all at last mere stock exchange counters, selling their principles to pay for their electioneering. And the great concern of the rich was naturally to keep property intact, the board clear for the game of trade. Just as the feudal concern had been to keep the board clear for hunting and war. The whole world was exploited, a battlefield of businesses and financial convulsions, the scourge of currency manipulation, tariff wars, made more human misery during the 20th century, because the wretchedness was dreary life instead of speedy death and at war, pestilence and famine, in the darkest hours of earlier history. His own part in the development of this time he now knew clearly enough. Through the successive phases, in the development of this mechanical civilization, aiding and presently directing its development, there had grown a new power, the council, the board of his trustees. At first it had been a mere chance union of the millions of Isbister and Warming, a mere property holding company, the creation of two childless testators' whims. But the collective talent of its first constitution had speedily guided it to a vast influence, until by title deed, loan, and share, under 100 disguises and pseudonyms it had ramified through the fabric of the American and English states. Wielding an enormous influence and patronage, the council had early assumed a political aspect, and in its development it had continually used its wealth to tip the beam of political decisions, and its political advantages to grasp yet more and more wealth. At last the party organizations of two hemispheres were in its hands. It became an inner council of political control. Its last struggle was with the tacit alliance of the great Jewish families. But these families were linked only by a feeble sentiment. At any time inheritance might fling a huge fragment of their resources to a minor, a woman or a fool. Marriages and legacies alienated hundreds of thousands at one blow. The council had no such breach in its continuity. Steadily, steadfastly it grew. The original council was not simply 12 men of exceptional ability. They fused. It was a council of genius. It struck boldly for riches, for political influence, and the two subserved each other. With amazing foresight it spent great sums of money on the art of flying, holding that invention back against an hour foreseen. It used the patent laws, and a thousand half-legal expedients, to hamper all investigators who refused to work with it. In the old days it never missed a capable man. It paid his price. Its policy in those days was vigorous, unerring, and against it as it grew steadily and incessantly was only the chaotic selfish rule of the casually rich. In 100 years Graham had become almost exclusive owner of Africa, of South America, of France, of London, of England and all its influence for all practical purposes, that is a power in North America then the dominant power in America. The council bought and organized China, drilled Asia, crippled the old world empires, undermined them financially, fought and defeated them. And this spreading usurpation of the world was so dexterously performed a prodigy hundreds of banks, companies, syndicates, masked the council's operations, that it was already far advanced before common men suspected the tyranny that had come. The council never hesitated, never faltered. Means of communication, land, buildings, governments, municipalities, the territorial companies of the tropics, every human enterprise, it gathered greedily. And it drilled and marshaled its men, its railway police, its roadway police, its house guards, and drain and cable guards, its hosts of land workers. Their unions it did not fight, but it undermined and betrayed and bought them. It bought the world at last. And, finally, its culminating stroke was the introduction of flying. When the council, in conflict with the workers in some of its huge monopolies, did something flagrantly illegal, and that without even the ordinary civility of bribery, the old law, alarmed for the profits of its complaisance, looked about it for weapons. But there were no more armies, no fighting navies. The age of peace had come. The only possible warships were the great steam vessels of the Council's Navigation Trust, the police forces they controlled, the police of the railways, of the ships, of their agricultural estates, their timekeepers and order keepers, outnumbered the neglected little forces of the old country and municipal organizations 10-1. And they produced flying machines. There were men alive still who could remember the last great debate in the London House of Commons. The legal party, the party against the council, was in a minority, but it made a desperate fight, and how the members came crowding out upon the terrace, to see these great unfamiliar wing-shapes circling quietly overhead. The council had soared to its power. The last sham of a democracy, that had permitted unlimited irresponsible property, was at an end. Within 150 years of Graham's falling asleep, his council had thrown off its disguises and ruled openly, supreme in his name. Elections had become a cheerful formality, a septennial folly, an ancient unmeaning custom, a social parliament as ineffectual as the convocation of the established church, in Victorian times assembled now and then, and a legitimate King of England, disinherited, drunken and witless, played foolishly in a second-rate music hall. So the magnificent dream of the 19th century, the noble project of universal individual liberty and universal happiness, touched by a disease of honor, crippled by a superstition of absolute property, crippled by the religious feuds that had robbed the common citizens of education, robbed men of standards of conduct, and brought the sanctions of morality to utter contempt, had worked itself out in the face of invention and ignoble enterprise, first to a warring plutocracy, and finally to the rule of a supreme plutocrat. His council at last had ceased even to trouble to have its decrees endorsed by the constitutional authorities, and he, a motionless, sunken, yellow-skinned figure, had lain, neither dead nor living, recognizably and immediately master of the earth, and awoke at last to find himself master of that inheritance. Awoke to stand under the cloudless empty sky and gaze down upon the greatness of his dominion. To what end had he awakened? Was this city, this hive of hopeless toilers, the final refutation of his ancient hopes? Or was the fire of liberty, the fire that had blazed and waned in the years of his past life, still smoldering below there? He thought of the stir and impulse of the song of the revolution. Was that song merely the trick of a demagogue, to be forgotten when its purpose was served? Was the hope, that still stirred within him, only the memory of abandoned things, the vestige of a creed outworn? Or added a wider meaning, an import interwoven with the destiny of man? To what end had he awakened? What was there for him to do? Humanity was spread below him like a map. He thought of the millions and millions of humanity following each other unceasingly forever out of the darkness of non-existence into the darkness of death. To what end? Aim there must be, but it transcended his power of thought. He saw for the first time clearly his own infinite littleness, saw stark and terrible the tragic contrast of human strength, and the craving of the human heart. For that little while he knew himself for the petty accident he was, and knew therewith the greatness of his desire. And suddenly his littleness was intolerable, his aspiration was intolerable, and there came to him an irresistible impulse to pray. And he prayed. He prayed vague, incoherent, contradictory things, his soul strained up through time, and space and all the fleeting multitudinous confusion of being, towards something he scarcely knew what, towards something that could comprehend his striving and endure. A man and a woman were far below on a roof space to the southward, enjoying the freshness of the morning air. The man had brought out a perspective glass to spy upon the council house, and he was showing her how to use it. Presently their curiosity was satisfied. They could see no traces of bloodshed from their position, and after a survey of the empty sky she came round to the crow's nest. And there she saw two little black figures, so small it was hard to believe they were men, one who watched, and one who gesticulated with hands outstretched to the silent emptiness of heaven. She handed the glass to the man. He looked and exclaimed, "I believe it is the master. Yes, I am sure. It is the master." He lowered the glass and looked at her, W waving his hands about, almost as if he was praying. "I wonder what he is up to. Worshipping the sun? There weren't parses in this country in his time, were there?" He looked again. He stopped it now. It was a chance attitude, I suppose. He put down the glass and became meditative. He won't have anything to do but enjoy himself, just enjoy himself. Ostrog will boss the show, of course. Ostrog will have to, because of keeping all these laborer fools in bounds. Them and their song. And got it all by sleeping, dear eyes, just sleeping. It's a wonderful world." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.